I'm here as a vulgar empiricist. I just watch the financial markets and try to figure out, make sense of what they do and say, so I'll just make a few comments along those lines. I should also confess that my econometrics is about junior high school level, so I won't be doing too much of that. Whenever I hear I used to say that I think the ultimate backing of the U.S. dollar was never really gold, but is the Pentagon. And as we have a less and less ability to finance the Pentagon, that may come under strain. But I think that U.S. military power is the ultimate source of much of our monetary power as well. If the power of the nature of a currency is defined in part through state coercion, then the power to coerce extends well beyond U.S. borders. And you can't say that of any other country. So I think that there's a very salient feature of why the dollar is still the world currency and not likely to be deposed from that role in the immediate future. But when I hear talk of gold, it was my old psychoanalytic tendencies come to the fore. I think of the classic analyses of Abraham and Ferenczi and their work on gold. It is, of course, as a lot of people know, it is the classic psychoanalysis of gold is that it's a form of transformed shit, or as Ferenczi said, it was odorless, dehydrated filth that has been made to shine. And I think there is a lot to this, that there is a certain psychology of retentiveness and sadism behind gold that always makes me think that it's kind of inseparable from a patriarchal family structure. That there's a kind of punitive father figure that gold is a projection of. And now that's all, you know, there's something severe and dry and mean about a gold standard. And if you ever go to a conference of gold bugs, you can see that as they're walking around. Whereas the credit system we live under is much more oral and insatiable and just all over the place. And, you know, to talk of liquidity is always the opposite of the dryness of the gold standard. So I think it's also the spread of credit money over the last 30, 40 years is also tied to the erosion of patriarchy. There's no longer that punitive father figure. Central bankers may try to step into that role. Paul Volcker did a pretty convincing imitation of that kind of punitive father figure, but certainly Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke don't really do that. They're too busy spreading money out of helicopters to be a punitive father. Whenever I hear people talk about gold, I also think of Keynes's notion that it's part of the apparatus of conservatism, that there's something about, even when Marxists invoke gold, there's this like idea that the state can't really change the market very much, that there's these powers of, that there's some sort of, that the state can't reject the judgments of the market over the long term. And maybe that's true over the very long term, but I think the state is enormously powerful at mitigating crises. The model I think we've been living under, or that the central bankers would like to put into effect and have been for the last, at least since the Volcker years, the Federal Reserve, is to try to run something that is more or less as stable as a gold standard, but has the flexibility in a crisis to prevent absolute collapse and deflation. And I know, for all the problems that we've gone through in the last 2 or 3 years, I think they've actually done a fairly credible job of doing that. The markets have gone nuts over quantitative easing. They think that somehow there's going to be this great inflationary spike because the U.S. has been printing so much money. But I think we've seen that perception change over the last week or so, as there's been a tremendous decline in commodity prices, because I just don't think that's the case. I think that quantitative easing is the fact that the Federal Reserve bought something like $1 trillion of U.S. Treasury paper through money of its own creation. I mean, what is central bank money? We could talk about that for a couple of hours. I still don't really understand the answer to that. But I think it did keep things from utterly falling apart. It hasn't been able to launch things back into a trajectory of prosperity by any means, but it did keep things from falling apart. So the notion that that this is going to lead to the United States turning into Argentina, a hyperinflationary Argentina sometime down the road, just makes no sense to me. I think a lot of this is the judgment of people who trade in the gold market. A lot of people who trade in the financial markets have a very simple notion of political economy. deficits mean inflation, buy gold. I mean, that's really, that's the extent of the reasoning behind a lot of this doubling of the gold price over the last couple of years. But yeah, if you look at the record of gold, it has a very poor record for predicting inflationary spikes. It reflects current inflation, but you could do a far better prediction of U.S. inflation by just copying today's consumer price index 6 or 12 months down the road than you could by looking at the gold price. That's a very poor record of prognostication. And as far as being a stable store of value, gold is not very good at that either. And the actual volatility of the real gold price is considerably more than the volatility of the nominal gold price. I mean, the value of gold is just all over the place because it's such a speculative instrument in a thin market that it's hard to think of it as any kind of real store of value. I think what determines the value of money is what it can buy, the goods and services that it can buy. So if you say that the gold price increases when the value of the dollar decreases, you're saying something that's really A equals A. You could say that the same thing about the price of cocaine or lipstick or turkey sausages. I mean, as the value of the dollar declines, the price of those things is going to rise. I'm not sure that gold really has a kind of special status that's worthy of all that much attention unless you maybe have psychological issues to address. On the issue of the deficits in Carl's paper, it's remarkable to me. I actually looked at some of the Congressional Budget Office's projections, which are supposedly the things that everybody's relying on for projecting deficits in the future. Now, if you look at those, you see that the deficits of the last few years, of 9 or 10% of GDP in the United States, are almost mostly the result of the financial crisis. The decline in tax revenues because of the decline in employment and profitability, the increase in spending for the stimulus program and the bailouts, and then more recently the temporary suspension of 2 points of the Social Security tax for the payroll tax for workers. According to the CBO's projections, once these pass, which should happen in the next year or two, they're looking for about a decade or so of deficits around 3% of GDP, which is not that much higher than the historical average has been in the United States. If you look at mandatory spending, the kinds of things that everyone worries about, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and several other programs, the increase in mandatory spending that the CBO projects over the next 10 years is about 1 percentage point of GDP. And that really is not an awful lot. The Pentagon budget over the last 10 years increased by 3 points of GDP. The Bush tax cuts are about 2.5% of GDP. So if you ended the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, put the Pentagon back to 2000 levels of spending, and let the Bush tax cuts expire, there is really no fiscal problem to worry about. So this hysteria right now is extrapolating a very atypical crisis experience into the long-term future and trying to create a sense of panic about this and lead to the erosion or dismantling of programs that the right has had it out for a long time, the programs of not only the Great Society but the New Deal. And these are very successful, very popular programs, so it's not an easy thing to undo, and even the Republicans are finding that their proposals for Medicare are going over like a lead balloon. So it's I would agree that this, the deficits are not anything to worry about. But as a matter of principle, I think over the very long term, you really don't want to run perpetual deficits and have the government debt expand forever. They're good for greasing the wheels a little bit and for counter-cyclical spending in a recession. But over the longer term, I think government borrowing is a cowardly substitute for taxing rich people. And what you're doing with all that borrowing, eventually, if the debt burden increases and increases, not if it's relatively stable, you're spending more and more of the government's, devoting more and more of government spending to servicing debt, paying off interest. And that really is an upward transfer of income from middle income people to very upper income people, and that's not a very wise thing to do. But the hysteria now about paying off the debt is lunatic. I think the last time U.S. government had zero debt was 1837. So I don't think that it's very likely we're ever going to get back to that. But The hysteria is unwanted, but unwarranted. But so too, I think, is complacency. You just can't think that you could magically run deficits forever and have no consequences for that. But I would say that the trade deficit is, or current account deficit, is to some degree a symptom of the erosion of U.S. manufacturing, that we just don't produce an awful lot of stuff here and have to import it. So, you know, whenever you look at the financials, the current account deficit is a kind of financial manifestation of that underlying problem that we buy so little. Now, there's a lot of talk lately about the revival of U.S. manufacturing. Manufacturing production and employment has actually picked up very impressively over the last year or so. I think the Boston Consulting Group just came out with a report saying that that the Chinese advantage is eroding a lot of manufacturing, and a lot of manufacturing can come back to the U.S., which should be a very interesting development and very profound, and also would do a lot to solve the current account problem. But I think that the notion that you can run current account deficits is not something to get panicked about in the short to medium term, but, you know, running deficits forever to the point where you have trillions of dollars abroad, that comes to be a problem. Jim O'Connor once said that debt increases capital's power over the state. If you have to borrow and roll over your debts, then you're always at risk of having somebody say, well, no, we're not going to roll that over, do what we say. This is certainly what we're seeing in Europe right now. I'll say more about that in a moment. But I would say it is something to worry about over the longer term. The United States probably cannot be the buyer of last resort forever, and maybe that this crisis is in part about that. That period is coming to a close, but nobody's really taken it on board yet. Nobody really understands what that means. One of the things that's impressed me about this whole financial crisis episode is that so much effort of policymakers has gone to kind of recreating the status quo before it all came to pass, that there's been really no change of thinking or understanding, and the fact that heavy borrowing to compensate for stagnant wages in the United States, nobody's rethought about that. Nobody's come to rethink that. And the endless notion of current account deficits and stimulating demand abroad. Can we do that forever? I don't know. I think perhaps we're talking about a period of a long-term relative erosion of U.S. power that is not going to be a total collapse, but it is. I don't think that to say that the current account deficit is not something to take seriously, I think is a little too complacent. And finally, about this talk of creating special drawing rights or alternatives to the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. I think what we're seeing with the crisis in Europe is in part the insanity of trying to create a currency where there's no coherent state that behind it. When the euro was being created, Timothy Garton Ash said, described it as a hair-raising adventure of unification through money. And I think we're seeing the contradictions of that process now coming through, we have this large multinational space with very different levels of productivity, very different fiscal systems, very different governmental systems, all under one monetary realm, and that doesn't seem to be working out very well. As David said, a lot depends upon the ability of Greece to impose austerity on its citizens, and there's talk in the markets the last day or two that Greece is going to pull out of the euro, which caused a great deal of panic yesterday. But I think it's also about the ability of Germany to get the Greek government to impose austerity on its citizens, because, you know, all this money that Greece owes is owed to German banks. So it's really Germany's problem as much as it is Greece's. Germany, it doesn't seem yet to have the political sophistication to be an imperial power that it needs. It's still adhering to some very old notions of austerity and righteousness, and I'm not sure that it's going to work very well. But, you know, if you look at that, the idea of creating some sort of synthetic international currency of the SDR seems even more fanciful. The euro had some degree of coherence to it. It was a system that was in evolution for 30 or 40 years. One continent and a political leadership that was trying to push towards more unification, more economic and political unification. But the idea of getting together China, Russia, India, Brazil, the United States, Europe, Japan, all to come up with some kind of synthetic currency seems utterly fanciful to me. If the euro is this much trouble, an SDR would seem to be impossible. And what you need, another thing you need for a reserve currency is to have deep financial markets where people can park lots and lots of money. That's one of the great advantages of the U.S. dollar is that the treasury market is so huge that you can park $100 billion in a treasury bond market and no one would even notice. There's no such thing in China, and I think the Chinese government would be very unwilling to open up its financial markets to that kind of free flow in and out. It would mean a loss of control by the central government over its economy. The euro, the euro has a common currency, but there is no common euro financial market. There's no euro treasury bond. I guess they could create some for these bailouts, but they're very small. So there's just really no credible rival for the dollar yet. So I think to talk, they can talk all they like about trying to create some sort of synthetic alternative, but we're a long, long way from that happening. So where does this all leave us with the idea of a world money? I think that something like this floating system, with the U.S. more or less at the center, is really, well, you can see a lot of problems with it. It's certainly the best we can do at this point. And it works surprisingly well. And I'm really kind of amazed how well the U.S. dollar has held up against its potential rivalries or against its monetary colleagues over the last couple of years. I mean, there has not been a panic flight from the dollar. And I think it's because, as David said, it's because when it all comes down to the final analysis, this is still a remarkably stable system politically and a remarkably resilient system that the old Timex watch commercial used to say, it takes a lick and it keeps on ticking.
Great. Thanks.